My name's Judith Brown, and I worked in Yemen for many years. I have a PhD in Arab and Islamic studies, and I follow the interests of what's happening in Yemen very closely. I have a lot of people that I know there, both in Sana'a, the capital, and in Aden, the which is in the south, Aden. And I've obviously been very alarmed about the current situation, the escalation of the war.
Can you tell us what, I mean, Yemen is a bit of an obscure country. What took you there in the first place, Judith?
I went to work as a manager of a refugee health project that was organised by UNHCR, and I stayed there for 2.5 years working there. And then after that contract finished, I went back and visited Yemen frequently. Part of my research was undertaken there. And it's a country that I really fell in love with the country and with the people, and found it a very hospitable, tolerant and friendly place, and it's remained in my heart ever since. And I've got good friends there that I think will always be friends.
Can you say something about the difference between North and South Yemen, and something about the politics that we can against all this? Because also, as I understand it, Yemen was divided up, the Sykes-Picot in the First World War.
Yemen was never subject to, Yemen is as old as China. It's a very ancient country, and it's the only country which the where no boundaries were drawn by the British, who occupied the Levant and most of Arabia. It occupies the southwestern corner of the Arabian Peninsula, and it was mentioned in the Quran and in very ancient texts. It's a very ancient country, the south of Yemen, the area around Aden, was occupied as a base because it's very central position, and it was a fueling station for boats, British boats on route to India, which of course was occupied by the British for many years. But the British never really got a very good hold on the occupation. The area that they occupied was around Aden. In the same way, the Ottomans tentatively had a hold on what's called North Yemen, but they only occupied really areas along the coastal region. In the same way, Yemen, as they call it, the graveyard of invaders, it's never been controlled by any outside power. It's always managed to control its own sovereignty. And
okay,
I think
so what's the relationship with Saudi Arabia? Because this is, you know, this is, they have a big, obviously a very long border, and it's, you know, main countries on the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, well, the southwest corner of Saudi Arabia, there's three provinces, and they, until the 1930s, they belonged to Yemen, and the British supported an extreme Islamic regime called the Wahhabis to actually fight and wrest that section off Yemen, and it's now part of Saudi Arabia. The border dispute carried on until about 2000, and then in return for sort of like peaceful relationships with Saudi Arabia, Yemen conceded the parts that it had captured in 1930, I think. And obviously Yemen is a very ancient country. It's been there for sort of thousands of years, whereas Saudi Arabia is a new country that was only formed in 1934 with the help of the British government.
In between them is this area called the Empty Quarter. Now, it's massive. Yeah. I mean, you know, is it really empty?
It's a desert. Some of it's a sandy desert, but a lot of it is rocky desert, mountains. It also extends across Oman as well. That area is desert. But I have to say, the west of Yemen has always been fertile and is still fertile now. Has a reasonable amount of rainfall in the summer, although it's dry in the winter. So that's why really it was a settled community there, because it had rainfall and it had the means of sort of like growing food and having farms. So therefore Yemen, that's why it's an ancient country, because it didn't have Bedou that wandered around the Arabian Peninsula. It had a settled community.
Yeah. So the strategic importance of Yemen, I think, is very difficult to underestimate. It seems a very, very important spot. Yemen, along with Ethiopia and Eritrea, control they're either sides of this Bab al Mandeb Strait, which is at the opposite end of the Red Sea, the south end, to the Suez Canal up at the north end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's Ethiopia doesn't have a coast now, but Somalia, Eritrea used to be part of Ethiopia, and it then bordered the Red Sea on the eastern side, but on the western side, that's controlled by Yemen. And Yemen was in two parts, because I think that the British and the Ottoman, when they occupied Yemen, as I said, they didn't control it as so much, but they actually took areas that they thought were under their control, and it was divided in two parts. There was a reunification in 1990. But the war has tended to divide them into two parts again. The Houthis, who are a Zaidi related to the previous ruling kingdom that had ruled Yemen for over 1,000 years, and in the eastern side, which is far more under UAE control, that's now ruled by a transition council that's very Salafist. It's much more extremist, that has been much more controlled by the United Arab Emirates, and has less sovereignty. But the area which is on the west side, which is called the old North Yemen, That's now ruled by the Houthis. As I say, they're remnants of the old ruling empire, and sovereignty is extremely important to them. So, and certainly they really have complete control on the west side of Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of north and south seems a bit confusing with east and west, because actually Yemen is a country which is elongated between east and west. And
yes, it is. North Yemen is actually in the west, and South Yemen is actually in the east. That's how. But it's given these strange
North-south names. I think we should try and always talk about it as east and west Yemen, really. We've also seen a declaration of war by Britain, even though they haven't sort of said it. Over the last week, and I was quite amazed to see on the various BBC programs, and even on the Question Time this week, not even a mention of it. You know, so we've got David Cameron announcing these strikes on Yemen, and yet no discussion about it, really.
No. I think the British position is a very difficult position. Yemen considers itself a signatory to the it is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, since it unified, it's made a recommitment to that to the Genocide Convention, and considers that there's a genocide happening in Gaza, and that it has a duty under as a signatory to the Genocide Convention to actually do what it can to stop that genocide. The seas around the Bab el-Mandab, which ships come through, is actually Yemen coastal waters. It's not open seas, it's Yemen coastal waters. So Yemen has said that through its coastal waters, it's not going to allow any ships that are bound for Israel to actually pass through those waters until the Israelis allow sufficient humanitarian aid and food into Gaza. So its position is absolutely clear. This is its Yemeni territorial waters. It's not open seas. Normally, when boats pass through those territorial waters, they actually are charged money, which goes into the Yemeni coffers. Yemen, because it's territorial waters, it can control who goes through those territorial waters legally. And what it said is no ships that may be supporting the genocide are going to be allowed through until we have evidence that the genocide has actually ended. So to me, that's a very sort of like moral position. I can't argue with it at all. And yet Yemen has been very blackened by the fact that it stopped boats going through its territorial waters for the first time ever. It's never ever done this before. So it's not part of an irrational thing going on. This is a sort of like a rational episode. And of course it's actually stated if food and humanitarian aid goes into Gaza, it'll allow Israeli boats through. So it's very clear.
How can they tell? I mean, do they look on the internet to see what a ship is as it's heading towards them, that it's somehow related to what's happening in Gaza, whether they let a ship through or not?
I really don't know when a boat's going through your territorial waters and it's given permission to pass through. Presumably certain information goes to the local authorities.
It's probably above our pay grade, that question.
Yes, it is. I can't say how they know.
No, anyway, but I mean, the importance of this is enormous, isn't it? And what do you think is the significance of the British deciding, number one, to launch these strikes along with the Americans on Yemen, and number two, on proscribing the Houthis? I mean, they talk about the Houthis as if they're a terrorist group, but actually it seems to me a bit like the Palestinians. They are their own people and they've got the right to do what they want.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Yemen sovereignty is extremely important to them, possibly because they've been at risk of occupation since the 1700s with the Ottoman Empire and the British Empire. And so therefore, this notion of sovereignty and self-control is so important. I mean, people talk about the Houthis being puppets of the Iranians, but it's absolutely not true. There have been several examples of when Iran has had a position during the period from 2015 to 2022, when the Iranians have had a position and have advised Yemen to do a certain thing, but the Houthis have said, no, that isn't what we want to do, and they've done what they want to do. I'm not saying that obviously they're allies, and in that respect there's a relationship between the two. Not so much at the beginning of the war in 2015, but from about 2017 onwards, there's been a developing relationship. But Yemen is very sovereign, so it's not an asset of Iran, and of course Iran supports anyone who has an anti-imperialist agenda
Saudis, have the Saudis stopped bombing Yemen? Is the war over?
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, funnily enough, a month after the start of the war on Ukraine, Saudi Arabia unconditionally stopped bombing Yemen, which made me think that the West wasn't able to supply sufficient weapons to both Ukraine and Saudi Arabia at the same time. There have been peace negotiations, and when a man was undertaking these as a sovereign country, they were going quite well. But then America sent a peace envoy there, and since then they've gone a bit upside down, and they haven't been conducted so smoothly. So there's no official peace between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. But quite interestingly, UK and USA asked Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to restart their bombing campaign in Yemen, and both of those countries refused. Obviously, UAE now has diplomatic relationships with Israel, but it's actually being quite strongly critical of Israeli actions in Gaza, and very supportive of the South Africa's filing a complaint of genocide at the International Court of Justice, both countries have been very influential in both the 57 Islamic states and in all of the nations in the Arab League, and actually both of those organizations are supporting the South African genocide complaint. So rather than supporting Israel and the and UK and USA, they've actually took a very definite stand in not supporting them. They certainly they've decided that they're not going to implement a war at the behest of US and UK in Yemen. So, and that's right.
What about this idea of saying the Houthis are a terrorist organization? I mean, surely they are actually now just the government of Yemen. And so there's a certain absurdity to calling them a terrorist organization.
Absolutely.
It's a little bit like calling the whole of Russia a terrorist organization.
Absolutely it is. But of course, terrorist, it simply means somebody that disagrees with you in terms of UK and American policy. So they just have a different political agenda, and the word terrorist and terrorism really are meaningless. There's no real legal agreement on what those terms mean. So therefore they can say it about any group that they want to, but of course that has political implications. Whether in fact other countries agree with that and don't prescribe the Houthis as terrorist organizations, that means that they can continue to operate in Yemen and support Yemen if they need to. I think that's an open situation, and I'm not quite sure how it will end.
So do you know, have you any idea what the effect of these strikes has been in Yemen?
One person told me that 5 people had been killed. This was 2 days ago, and I haven't heard since. I haven't spoken to anyone for the last 2 days. One person told me that no one had been killed, and one person told me that 5 people have been killed. I did read on the internet that no people had been killed. So, and that was 2 days ago. I haven't had news yesterday or today yet. But I think that the difficulty is most of the missile bases that they've got in Yemen, they're really sophisticated weaponry that they've got, and very precision missiles. But they're all mobile. None of them have definite bases. So therefore, they're very difficult there isn't a lot of intelligence inside Yemen supplying US and UK with information relating to targets, and they've got mobile missile stations. So I think
They'll be using satellites, surely.
Who? They definitely will be using satellites, yes. But it's difficult for them to pick out, because the missiles are all mobile. In other words, they shoot missiles they're not in fixed positions. The missile launchers are mobile, so therefore they can be moved, as far as I understand it.
Okay. Well, what about HMS Diamond? You know, this massive, apparently, well, I don't know, destroyers aren't the massivest of ships, but it seems to be sitting there in the Red Sea with all these poor Royal Navy soldiers on there, almost like bait.
Yeah. Yeah. I really don't understand Western politics at all these days. It seems as if it's everything that they're doing isn't in their own interests. Although, of course, particularly American interests, and I suspect UK interests as well, in Gaza include the building of the Ben Gurion Canal. Which is a new canal that's going to be formed in Israel, which is going to replace the Suez Canal. They hope it's going to be much bigger and wider, and so it can take bigger ships and it can take two-way traffic, which the present Suez Canal doesn't take, and they want that to enter the Mediterranean at Gaza, and then they're going to implement a new trade route to challenge the Belt and Road trade route that China's planning. So obviously America has a lot of interest in that, and so it may be that that's influencing American and British opinions, because they have commercial interests. And of course, the other thing is that the East Levant gas basin, Israel, it wants to claim that for itself instead of dividing it between the Palestinians and Lebanon. So that's another feature of the war as well.
What is the point, do you think, of having these British ships and American ships and submarines in the Red Sea? Because it doesn't seem as if they're able to actually make enough of an impact to stop the Yemenis or anybody else controlling the Red Sea. You know, they may be sunk themselves. And in fact, if you look at the equipment that these countries have got, particularly obviously the Yemenis at the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and around that area, they could likely sink one of these warships at any time they wanted to. So it just seems to me a whole thing is a totally pointless exercise. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. But I just think that what they're doing is protecting commercial interests in ridding the population ridding Gaza of its population in order to implement commercial interests of US, UK and Israel. And so whatever costs it's going to take in terms of tackling other areas like Lebanon and Yemen, I think that they're prepared to pay a price, because they think that the price of better commercial interests will be worth it.
Yeah, could well be. They're sort of there to just protect the money, and that's why but they can't protect the money. Because they will stop whichever ships they want going through. Excuse me. Well, look, finally, do you want to say something about Gaza? Because it's all related, this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I listened to all of the information relating to South Africa's appeal to the ICJ on a claim of genocide. I felt it was extremely plausible, extremely well presented, extremely well researched, and I felt that it was very very reliable information. I also listened to the Israeli response, and I felt that that did contain flawed evidence, evidence that, for example, reporters such as Jonathan Cook and Max Blumenthal have actually, and Grayson have actually refuted that information. They actually presented some of that in the Israeli defense. But I felt that overall the Israeli position was much, much weaker, was less well presented. The information that they presented could be challenged. And what they were saying was, because these Israelis have been killed, we've got a right to kill as many Palestinians as we want. And in fact, a genocide to prevent a genocide is still illegal. So I felt that that case was very good. But the situation in Gaza itself is still horrific. I understand that it's a lot of the bombing has become much lower intensity. But of course, the northern part of Gaza is really completely destroyed anyway. It's a very difficult situation, and it's. How that's going to be ended, it's very difficult to imagine, because
for many people looking at this, Judith, they're saying, what is the point? Why are the Israelis doing this?
Yes, exactly. And the only reason is because they want to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their own land. There can't be any other reason.
Yeah, so it's a kind of land grab, basically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Is there anywhere people can follow you, either on social media or elsewhere?
I've just set up my Substack, which is called The Control of Information. So if they go onto Substack and look at The Control of Information, but I've only just started posting there this week. So it's a new Substack. It's looking at how information is controlled and censored, and hopefully I'll be able to post a lot of new information on there in the near future. So I welcome people to go on that site and look at it.
Okay, because I mean, this is one of your qualifications as well, isn't it? You did a bit
of work
on that. Okay, Dr. Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tony.